Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 60, Retrospective on the Great Persecution. It's taken us 9 episodes to chronicle the entire story of the Great Persecution and its associated events. I stated back in our second introduction episode that the Great Persecution is the key turning point in our narrative. An age of dramatic, unprecedented transition for the early church. We began with Diocletian's fateful decision to terminate the Christian religion, and we have ended with the conversion of Constantine and the obliteration of the Tetrarchic regime. Reflecting on this narrative, there are, I think, some interesting observations we can draw. Observations which will help us process what we have covered thus far and help orient us to what lies ahead. On a personal note, writing these past episodes has been both enjoyable and challenging. The story of the Great Persecution, the Tetrarchy, and the rise of Constantine is so epic and so important that it's my favorite period of early church history. It's a story I've been waiting to tell since the podcast began. However, the complexity of the narrative presented me with a host of challenges. The Great Persecution is less an event and more of a 10-year period in the history of the early church. There's the story of the persecution from the imperial perspective, the events which led up to Diocletian's final decision, and the various ways the persecuting emperors carried out their repressive policies. It's also the story of the different Christian communities who had to confront this horrific situation. The martyrs, of course, take center stage, but there are also the survivors, like Eusebius and Lactantius. Divisions within the church played an important role in our narrative, from the factional conflict in Rome and Africa, to the Miletian schism in Egypt, to the controversy over Origen in Palestine. Some of these narrative threads I was able to cover in full, while others have been only briefly discussed, with more in-depth coverage postponed for a future episode. On top of all this is the heavy dose of imperial history we've had to cover, the rise and fall of the Tetrarchy, and the kaleidoscope of shifting Roman emperors. Often when I read histories of this period, I've seen two approaches. One places the focus on the emperors. The great persecution and mass death and suffering of early Christians simply plays a part in the broader discussion of Diocletian's reforms. The other approach is a more devotional one, where an individual martyr or group of martyrs is the focus, instead of the persecutors. However, this approach usually lacks any real reference to the wider imperial situation, creating a vague and ill-defined setting for the story of the martyr. Integrating these two approaches into one narrative has been a major goal of mine in composing these episodes. One which required me to put a great deal more thought into how I arranged the material. I opted for an alternating approach, where one episode we stayed in the Greek East, and in the next journeyed to the Latin West, flipping back and forth between the two halves of the empire. I hope this approach has made things easier to follow, and has not been confusing. I've tried to place chronological synchronisms at the beginning and end of each episode, along with a recap of earlier events to help you keep everything straight. Hopefully this repetition has been more helpful than annoying. Writing these episodes has really tested my skills as a narrative storyteller. In some ways, the persecution has been a trial by fire for the show, one I hope has prepared me to tell the even more complex series of events which await us. Ultimately, you are all the judge as to whether or not I succeeded in telling the story of the Great Persecution. I'd like now to focus on some specific insights we can take from the narrative. Focusing on the Roman Empire first, one thing which has struck me is the interpenetration of imperial politics and church affairs. The sometimes dizzying array of shifting emperors caused respites in the persecution, giving the early Christians some much-needed relief. First was the abdication of Diocletian and Maximian in 305, which effectively ended the persecution in the West and produced a lull in the East. Then the Conference of Carnuntum in 308, which was called to deal with the civil wars in the West, and ended up distracting Galerius and Maximinus Daya, as the two of them argued over titles and rank. Then we had Galerius's deathbed recantation, and the power vacuum left in his wake, both of which forced Maximinus to break off his assault on the church. Constantine's defeat of Maxentius in the west also triggered a respite in the east, after he issued his letter to Maximinus. Last of all, there was the final war between Maximinus and Licinius. It's frightening to imagine what would have happened had Maximinus been victorious at the Battle of Zeralum. The vow he made to Jupiter to wipe out the Christian name speaks to the scale of bloodshed he was willing to go to. Who knows how emboldened he would have been by victory in the civil war, or how a war between him and Constantine would have turned out. Thankfully, events played out differently. The lapses in the persecution also highlight something key about the governance of the Roman Empire. A top-down, imperially driven policy, like the Great Persecution, required the active attention of the emperor to enforce it. Every time the persecuting emperors were distracted by major political events, active persecution was greatly reduced or even ceased. Even when zealously anti-Christian governors were in charge, like Hierocles or Firmilianus, the number of martyrs declined without a vested imperial interest. This suggests that imperial policy initiatives required the ongoing, proactive effort of the central government to maintain enforcement. Thus, the Great Persecution reveals both the strengths and limits of imperial power. When an emperor really set out to enforce his new laws, they were dutifully carried out by subordinates, especially those looking to gain favor. However, if an emperor simply decreed something novel, provincial enforcement could be lukewarm. In many ways, this is similar to the persecutions of the past. In the early years, persecution required an anti-Christian provincial governor or a hostile local populace to produce martyrs. Without these active participants, Christians were left relatively alone, even though the threat of persecution still remained. These two conclusions are things we should not forget as the narrative progresses. Imperial politics at the highest level directly impacted the early church, and new top-down religious policies required an active emperor to enforce them. Let's now turn our attention to the early church itself. With so much to cover, and wanting to keep each episode in the 25 to 35 minute range, certain things had to be cut. As many of you are no doubt aware, there were far more martyrs in this period than just those we discussed. I made the decision to largely stick to those martyrdom accounts which historians regard as reliable and authentic. This means excluding some of the more famous martyrs, such as the military Saint George, famous in later legend for slaying a dragon, or Catherine of Alexandria, after whom the monastery on Mount Sinai would later be named. This resulted in a narrative bias towards those regions from which our best evidence comes, namely Africa, Egypt, and Palestine. However, though most of the stories of martyrs from other parts of the Roman Empire have been obscured by pious legends, Christians in those areas nevertheless suffered greatly, and we should not forget that. Behind the exaggerated tales of later hagiographers lie real historical martyrs, whose names, if not their histories, have survived. A good example of how the memory of a martyr can evolve into something which bears little resemblance to the historical person is Procopius of Scythopolis. Procopius, you'll remember, was the first Palestinian martyr recorded by Eusebius for this period. He was a reader, exorcist, and Syriac interpreter in the Church of Scythopolis. I've reposted a picture of a Greek icon of Procopius alongside this episode. You may notice that Procopius is dressed in military garb. Why is this so? Because in the Middle Ages, Procopius was transformed beyond all recognition into one of the many Byzantine military martyrs. Now, this is, of course, a fairly extreme example, but it is far from uncommon. An even more extreme example is Saint Alexandra of Rome, or Saint Alexandra the Empress. Alexandra is said to have been the wife of Diocletian, and was martyred for her Christian faith. But of course, you all know that Diocletian's wife was named Prisca, and she was killed by Licinius, not for her alleged Christian faith, but because of her dynastic connections. So, where in the world did Saint Alexandra come from? I have read that there is an alternative version of her story, where she is instead the wife of a Roman governor. If this is historical, then Alexandra was at some later point upgraded to being the wife of the emperor himself, perhaps to give her story a more dramatic edge. I hope you can therefore see why I decided to avoid legendary martyrdom accounts. Such discussions would have derailed the podcast. It would have made for some pretty poor listening if every other sentence ended with a caveat from me explaining how the acts of this or that martyr aren't entirely trustworthy. Not to mention, such legendary accounts tell us far more about the beliefs of the later Christians who composed the accounts, and don't typically give us good historical insight into the early 4th century. A few listeners asked me why I didn't provide more detail on martyrs in specific regions like Spain or Roman Mesopotamia, but I hope from this discussion you can see why. Finally, we should also remember that the names of numerous other martyrs have not come down to us. Remember the chance survival of the acts of Stephen the Presbyter in Upper Egypt? One scholar I've read determined only about 850 martyrs from this era have had their names preserved down to the present day. A small portion of the thousands of Christians who died for their faith in this period. I think there is a somewhat romantic notion out there that persecution was ultimately good for the early church. Persecution allowed for heroic displays of martyrdom in the face of state-sponsored violence, and the Christian community was only strengthened by these experiences, demonstrating its resilience to the world. But of course, we know that wasn't always the case. The issue of the lapsed proved over and over again to be bitterly divisive. Passions ran high as rigorous viewed apostates and others as traitors to Christ, while the repentant lapsed demanded mercy and readmittance. These fractures went all the way up to the bishop, as we saw with Cyprian and Dionysius back in the 3rd century, and most recently with the violence in Rome and the conflict between Peter of Alexandria and Meletius of Lycopolis. Even the martyrdom of someone like Cyprian or Peter wasn't enough to put an end to the conflict. It is, of course, true that many Christians were greatly strengthened in their resolve by the example of the martyrs, but this cannot allow us to ignore the real and long-lasting damage the persecutions inflicted. Another area of damage specifically caused by the Great Persecution was the mass destruction of Christian material culture. To this day, no church buildings survive from before Constantine, except for the rare example of Dura Europos. We do know Christians had large church buildings, like the one raised in Nicomedia, but we are completely ignorant as to their structure and appearance. The early Christian art and architecture they contained is irrecoverably lost. Such is also the case with texts. It is not until the 4th century that we possess complete manuscript copies of the Christian Bible. Until then, we only have papyri fragments. Diocletian, notably, was the first emperor to specifically target Christian books. Prior persecutions did not deliberately go after the scriptures. But Diocletian and his government recognized Christianity was a book-centric religion. Of course, there are many factors which affect the preservation of the ancient manuscripts through time, but the enforcement of Diocletian's first edict is certainly one of them. It is also important to remember that liturgical books and other Christian texts were ordered destroyed. Of course, the worst destruction wrought in this period was the human factor. I'm not going to attempt to estimate the actual number of Christians killed, statistics for ancient history are almost always problematic. I do, however, want you to know that I appreciate the fact that much of the material in these past episodes has been violent and difficult to listen to for some listeners. I've struggled with how far is too far when going into the details of how different martyrs were tortured and killed. I've tried to keep the content respectful without sugarcoating the bloodshed. The sheer scale of the violence needs to be appreciated in order to understand the perspective of the generation of Christians who lived through this age of transition. Imagine being Lactantius in Nicomedia, or Eusebius in Palestine, and witnessing all the gruesome ways your fellow believers were killed, many of whom were your close friends. Then imagine your reaction when a new emperor comes on the scene who both ends the persecution and embraces your faith as his own. Whatever we might think of this turnaround, Christians like Lactantius and Eusebius clearly saw the hand of God in all this, guiding his people through history. We will have much more to say about the impact of the end of persecution and Constantine's conversion upon the early church. However, if we want to understand the relationship between the emperor and the church in the upcoming episodes, then we need to remember his role in ending the persecution. The shadow of the Great Persecution hangs over the rest of the century. Constantine was the first of the 4th century emperors to decree official toleration and likely property restitution, which he did right after he came to power in 306. Upon becoming senior emperor in 312, he used his new position to halt Maximinus Daya's renewed onslaught. At Milan, it was Constantine who induced Licinius to extend pro-Christian policies to the east. As I've alluded to before, when Licinius himself eventually turns against his Christian subjects, it will be Constantine who defeats him and restores liberty to the Eastern churches. Much has been and will be said about the first Christian emperor and his place in the history of the early church. At the very least, though, I think we have to follow Lactantius and Eusebius and give Constantine his due for bringing an end to the persecutions. He does at least deserve credit for that. Next episode, we will get into one of those scars left by Diocletian as we finally circle back to events in North Africa and witness how the legacy of the Great Persecution permanently rent the church there apart. Thank you for listening. If you have questions or feedback about the podcast, you can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmo.com. Please don't forget to rate and review the show on whatever podcast platform you use. Be sure to visit the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast. And don't forget to visit the website at historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.